You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Ayn Rand's For the New Intellectual by Ankar Gatte.
Thanks, everyone, for joining today. Welcome. Taking some time off on a Saturday. I hope this will be interesting. As Keith said, I've been asked to kick it off. In this whole session, we're going to talk broadly about what it means to be an intellectual and specifically an objectivist intellectual. And there's three points that I'd like to cover in my remarks. So I'm going to talk a little bit about why I became an objectivist intellectual. And Keith mentioned this is the 60th anniversary. I don't know if you can see this. I think I've got it up near the camera. This is Ayn Rand's For the New Intellectual. It's the 60th anniversary of this book. I'm going to talk a little bit of the lead essay is called For the New Intellectual. It had a real impact on me. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, of why I became an objectivist intellectual. Then second, I want to talk a little bit about sort of what the job is of an intellectual viewed from Ayn Rand's perspective and why it's important, why it's consequential, and really for good or bad. Things can go really well when intellectuals are doing their job. Things can go quite badly when intellectuals are not doing their job. So what the job is, why it's so important. And then third, I want to talk a little bit about what it takes and why it's so interesting and so rewarding. So that's what I'm going to try to cover in this, in my remarks this morning, or at least it's morning Eastern time. I know we've got people all around the world, so it's some people it's afternoon or even evening. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit in personal terms and in part, so why I became an objectivist intellectual. There's really two books that changed the direction of my life. And the second one is For the New Intellectual. The first thing that I read of Rand's was Atlas Shrugged. I hope you can see this cover, which is the last of her fictions and really her masterwork, last of the four novels she wrote, We the Living, Anthem, The Fountainhead, and Atlas Shrugged. It's her masterwork. And it's the first thing I read. And the reason I read it is I already had a sense. So I read it late in high school. And I already had a sense that something is wrong or something is off with the world. And that's the way I thought of it as a teenager in high school. What it really meant is that something is weird and off in my school environment. Like, so the world sort of was the school environment when you're a high school student. And specifically what really puzzled me and seemed strange and wrong-headed was that I was in a school, and I think fairly typical. I was educated in Canada, not a great school, but not a bad school. But it was a school environment in which the adults and what they valued seemed off to me. And in particular, this is a school that's supposed to be about knowledge, education, the pursuit of figuring out what's true and really working at it. And most of my teachers seemed sort of interested in their students, but not really interested in learning, interested in knowledge. So what really stood out at the time for me is I had math teachers who didn't know the subject. I was often in math class reading novels and reading science fiction because what was being taught, I had already figured out by just looking at the textbook. So it wasn't challenging at all. Often the teachers weren't even qualified to be teaching math. So I remember one year where I was reading a lot of science fiction and the teacher at various times would, like, so she knew that I was reading science fiction in the class, and she would periodically, when she was doing exercises on the board and was stuck, would ask me what the answer is. And it's not because, the point here is not I was some math genius. It's the school was pretty bad, but the teacher wasn't even embarrassed. That she would laugh and say, like, I'm stuck here, what do I do? The teacher wasn't embarrassed that she didn't know more than the students. about math. And this was sort of the whole school environment, with the exception of a few teachers, but characterizing the school as it was pretty mediocre, and the teachers weren't particularly interested in knowledge. And that seemed really strange to me. Like, this is a school. Shouldn't that be its main focus? And if you take a contrast, and there was this kind of contrast at school, the sports coaches, so our school was good at volleyball, the coaches were interested in figuring out new things, new strategies, taking the best kids and making them better at volleyball. So if you contrasted that to what it seemed like, what the main purpose of the school should be is the pursuit of knowledge, it wasn't focused on that. It wasn't particularly interested in that. And from that, I got the idea. So what is very different is I have a different view of what should be valued, what's valuable, what's not, what's good, what's bad, what people should be focused on and not. And I got the idea that I have a different view of what's good and evil from the kind of the adults in my school environment. And then what I started was an exploration of, well, what is good and evil? How should you think about that? And I started a research project. And it was at that point that someone told me, well, this is what you're interested in. If this is what you're exploring and trying to figure out, you should read this novel, Atlas Shrugged. And so I said, as I said, I was pretty bored in school. So yeah, I'll read this novel. And I mean, I got gripped by it from the very start. I think I read it in 3 or 4 days, 1,000-page novel. And what really struck me was, one, the seriousness with which Ayn Rand takes ideas. And Atlas Shrugged, if you've read it, it's a story that's kind of society-wide and culture-wide in scope. And it takes the whole issue of the ideas that are dominant in a society or a culture, it's enormously important, that they have enormous impact for good or for bad. And one of the things that I got early on from Atlas Shrugged is that the ideas that are dominating the society in Atlas Shrugged, and it's a society that's in decay, are ideas that I had heard all my life. And again, all my life means for 17 years or 16 years, but that's how you experience it as a high school student. Like, I had heard these ideas in watered down form usually, but some version of the ideas that are dominating the society in Atlas Shrugged, I had heard these ideas all my life. And Atlas Shrugged's arguing that there's something really, really wrong with these ideas. And it's showcasing that on a grand scale of the way in which these ideas are undermining. And it's both at a very personal level and at a social political level. And I think if you're a real intellectual, what Ayn Rand means by an intellectual, you need to be focused on both, the way ideas shape individual lives, and as a consequence, the way that they shape social political issues and social political trends. So I'll give you one instance at a personal level that really impacted me. One of the main ideas running through the story and shaping the story's events is called in Atlas Shrugged the soul-body dichotomy. It's more often called the mind-body dichotomy. This is the idea in various forms. I mean, it has various forms. One of the ideas is that there's morality on one side and practicality on the other side, and they're at loggerheads. They're in tension with one another. You can either be moral, and that means being impractical, or you can focus on the practical things in life, and that means at the very least putting morality to one side. It often means it's acting immorally. There's various manifestations of the idea that soul and body, or mind and body, are pitted against each other. And this is a theme in the novel, in particular for one of the characters, Hank Reardon, which is the character, when I was reading it at 16, the character who resonated the most with me. And I could see in my own thinking that I had real elements of the mind-body dichotomy. And you get in the story of how it undermines, how it undermines Hank Reardon in the story, and more broadly, the ways at a social, political level, it creates all kinds of problems. And what Atlas Shrugged also presents is it projects a positive alternative. So it's focused on ideas that I thought of as, yeah, these are ideas that dominate in the world that I've encountered. So including this, I mean, most particularly my school environment. But it presents an alternative, an alternative way to live. It has a new sense of idealism, of this is what to strive for. But again, not if you think of the moral and the practical, or there's the next world and there's this world, this veil of tears, you should be striving for heaven, but heaven belongs in another life and another dimension. What Atlas Shrugged was stressing is, no, you should be focused on the ideal, that's right, but the ideal in this world, what's possible in this world. And if you have the right ideas, you can reach, in effect, heaven on earth. And the metaphor in Atlas Shrugged, the way it's portrayed, it's Atlantis. But it's Atlantis, it's reachable here now on earth if you have the right ideas. And it's tremendously inspiring. And what I want to stress here is it's the importance it's placing on ideas. And then there's the question of where do these ideas come from? And this is, I think of the For the New Intellectual. This is Ayn Rand writing of just a few years after Atlas Shrugged. And I think of the lead essay in this book as really a companion piece to Atlas Shrugged. And it's a call to arms. And that's how I experienced it at 16, 17. It says you can do something about the world the way it is. There's a profession that got us here that has spewed all kinds of mistaken and even evil ideas. It's got us into a predicament that we've got ideas that are leading us to bad things, leading us astray. It's the result of a certain profession, and there's a profession that can get you out of it as a result. And it's the same profession. And what she's arguing in this lead essay For the New Intellectual is that it's philosophers and more broadly intellectuals. And that roughly means the people who are specializing in the fields of the humanities. So it certainly includes philosophy, but history, economics, psychology, the sciences that study man and man's basic nature, that study human nature, that this is what it's errors and worse on the part of intellectuals in the humanities that have led to all kinds of ideas that are undermining one in the personal life. So for instance, the mind-body dichotomy has a whole long intellectual tradition that's behind it, a whole slew of arguments. And it's if you're ready to rethink these ideas, you can set your own life on a much more positive direction. And more broadly, you can help set the social and political cultural trends in a more positive direction. And one of the things that Ayn Rand emphasizes in For the New Intellectual, that's very interesting. I'm only going to mention it, but we'll have opportunity, I think, in this whole day to talk more about this. She stresses that if you're going to have positive ideas that are moving us forward towards in our personal lives, towards better, happier, more rewarding lives, and in our kind of social, political, cultural trends, moving us in the direction of progress, what you need is the intersection of intellectuals in the humanities with scientists and particularly businessmen. And one of the ways that she puts it, there's the makers of knowledge and there's the makers of wealth. And that for you to be moving forward in your own life and for a society to be moving forward, it has to be really focused on both of these. That it's what you need to do is make new knowledge and you have to make new wealth. This is how human beings live. We produce and you can produce in both realms. You produce new knowledge and you produce new wealth. It's not seized from anyone else. It's created, it's produced. And what the intellectual is focused on is more the, he's a maker of knowledge. And what businessmen are focused on, they're makers of wealth. But it's the combination of these two that is what is needed if we're talking about moving towards the ideal and moving towards or in a positive direction. And you have opportunities. I mean, Tal, my CEO now at ARI, he comes from the business world. We'll have John Allison later, who comes from on a panel, who comes from the business world. So as I say, there'll be more opportunity to talk about this, but this is a very interesting point that Ayn Rand is making, and which I also found inspiring. And so what my, I changed my career direction from being interested and figuring that in university, I'm going to study physics and probably engineering to, no, I'm going into an intellectual career in the sense of into the humanities. I did a double major in economics and philosophy, one more focused on the conditions that make wealth possible, the other focused on the conditions that make knowledge possible. And it's I took it like inspiring from For the New Intellectual, that it's a call to arms, that this is a profession, it's a real career. And it's, it turns out it's the career that I was really interested in, because I was thinking about these ideas even before encountering Ayn Rand and reading Atlas Shrugged and reading For the New Intellectual. And what she's arguing and what convinced me in For the New Intellectual is that this is really valuable work to do. And now that's what I want to talk about a little bit. And part of what I did is when I changed career directions, I looked to ARI because I wanted to learn more about Rand and more about objectivism, to how can they how can the Institute help me in that process. I actually helped jumpstart the educational programs they were offering. They were kind of suspended for a while, but I was lobbying with the Institute that if you start them up again, you've got at least one student who will take these things. And that helped me tremendously in my education. All the education that I got from the Institute, in addition to my university studies at the undergraduate and graduate level. Now, let me talk a little bit about what the job is from Rand's perspective, and this is how I think of it as well, and why it's so consequential. One of the ways she puts it in For the New Intellectual, from a positive perspective, and I'm quoting, she says, quote, "The intellectual is the eyes, ears, and voice of a free society. It is his job to observe the events of the world, to evaluate their meaning, and to inform the men in all the other fields." Close quote. So again, she puts it, it's the eyes, ears, and voice of a free society. And that's in a positive sense. That what the job of an intellectual is to help people understand and process the world around them. And one way you can put it is, and this is now kind of broadening it, as I said, that she's putting it, the an intellectual from a positive perspective is the eyes, ears, and voice of a free society. If you broaden it to not just proper intellectuals, but intellectuals who've done things for good or bad, I think the way to think about what they're doing, one simple way to think about it is they're providing a framework that tells people, this is where we've come from, this is where we are, and this is where we should go. And when you look at major ideas and ideological movements that gain traction, that become dominant and mainstream, I think this is what they're putting the world into, this kind of framework that helps people process it or misprocess it, either understand it or misunderstand it, but it's at least the illusion of having an understanding. So if you think, for instance, of Marxism and communism, that Marxism starts to dominate in the 19th century and then into the 20th century, has a huge impact on the world. It's a story of where we've come from, where we come from a more feudal system, and there's economic forces that are shaping everything, and there's contradictions in the system, and there's a movement towards capitalism, but capitalism itself has the conditions that are going to undermine it. So there's a story of and a narrative of this is where we've come from, this is where we are. So we're now in the 19th century, in the midst of the Industrial Revolution, and it's the product of growing wealth production, of a really new form of economic organization, capitalism. This is where we are, but it has, from Marx's perspective, it has all kinds of problems. It has contradictions. Where should we go? Well, there's something better to this. We need to move towards socialism and finally to communism. Yeah, there's going to be a period of a dictatorship, but somehow that is going to wither away. And so, but this is the direction that we should go. So what an intellectual framework in the humanities is providing is this is where we've come from, this is where we are, and this is where we should go. To take something contemporary, if you take to use a name, if you take the kind of wokeism in the US today, it's again a story of where have we come from? Well, we're come from a period of 200 plus years that's, again, in this story or this narrative, that's dominated by racism and slavery. Where are we now? We're still in a country that's plagued by white supremacy. Where should we go? What direction do we need to head in? Well, we have to work to be anti-racist. And so there's a whole, again, story and a framework in which a way to look at where we are, where we've come from, where we should go. And that's what I think broadly Ayn Rand's arguing that intellectuals do, that history is something that really unfolds before your very eyes. And it's the question of how are you going to process it? And there's a real division of labor. So other people in other fields, engineering, physics, the business world, if you're in the arts, you're focused on your job, career, your particular work. I mean, division of labor means you leave some things to some people and you focus on specialized tasks. And the intellectual is a specialized task. And what the intellectual is doing is helping people, or helping or not, but it's giving people tools or things that aren't tools but seem like it, to understand what is happening in the world. And that people don't have the time, the energy to focus on it for themselves. So it's the intellectuals that set the framework for everybody else. And in For the New Intellectual, Rand talks a lot about this issue of the rise of Marx and the socialists, that it doesn't, if you want to explain it, you have to go back to the earlier ideas. And when out of the Enlightenment, a new form of society is arising, including a new form of economic organization. And people are seeing that it's, okay, now not everybody's a farmer. People are moving to the cities, factories are growing. The division of labor is, it's people are much less self-sustaining. There's much more trade going on. How are we to understand all of this? Like, what is happening? Why is it happening? Is it good? How should we carry this out further? An intellectual helps people process that. It's they're busy living their own lives, and intellectuals have to establish a framework. And part of what she argues in For the New Intellectual and many of her other essays is intellectuals failed at the task in the late 18th and into the 19th century. Even the best of the people grappling with the new culture that is arising. And I think of these particularly, they're both philosophers and economists like Adam Smith and people like Ricardo, John Stuart Mill and his father and Bentham. They're trying to understand this new system, but they fail in all kinds of ways of getting what's distinctively good about it, how it operates. One of the major errors is to put way too little emphasis on the role of the mind in creating new knowledge, in creating new wealth, of thinking of it much too much in terms of physical labor. Physical labor had existed for thousands of years. What was liberated by the Enlightenment was the mind and the free thinker. And when people started using their minds both to focus on, look, we can create all kinds of new knowledge, the sciences explode in the Enlightenment and into the 19th century, we can create all kinds of new knowledge, we can be makers of knowledge, and we can be makers of wealth. And so for the first time, you have people, whether they're poor, rich, whatever their station in lives, their station in life, and what their parents did and their grandfather and grandmother did, they can set out to new careers, new ventures. And there was much too little understanding of this. And part of what happens with the rise of Marx and the socialists is they emphasized and hammered home on the idea that, no, there's not really makers of knowledge. It's all the result of the system and of economic forces. And there's not really makers of wealth. And to the extent there is, it's the result of physical labor. So, and they're being exploited in this new system, and we need a better system. So, and it's all of this, I think, is false. The whole Marxist story is false, but it had a plausibility because the intellectuals who need to be developing the principles to understand this new form of living that's arising in the 19th century. It's the first time you get a middle class. It's a massive transformation. And the job of the intellectual is to understand it, interpret it for people. And if he fails to do that, then you get people who start to dominate who don't have good ideas, but they seem like, okay, at least gives us some kind of understanding of what is going on. And we need a framework. So if people don't develop a good one, a true one, someone's going to come along and develop ones that are bad and that are not true, but have some plausibility, and people will latch on to those. And that, so there's a deep perspective in For the New Intellectual of the rise of socialism and more deeply of collectivism and a turning away from the Industrial Revolution. And it was the result of intellectuals. And the task of an intellectual now is to try to put to understand the world and put it on a better framework, better perspective in which to understand things. And this is across the field. So we have panelists who will be talking about, say, for instance, about law and government. We have a number of people who are focused on this kind of issue. Tara Smith, Adam Mossoff, Larry Salzman, Brad Thompson are all interested that America was an enormous achievement. And the creation of the country, the writing of the Constitution, but there's an ongoing issue of how do you understand what this achievement is and was? What are its basic principles? How do you carry it forward? How do you preserve it? And there's various theories about the nature of the Constitution, how to understand it, some of which I think have really undermined the American achievement, particularly the undercutting of property rights. And that, again, if you look at why it happened, it was intellectuals reinterpreting the meaning of the Constitution, fundamental American principles. And so, and that's what intellectuals do. And this is what the Founding Fathers did. And I think an enormously positive achievement. This is what the socialist and Marxist in the 19th century did in interpreting the Industrial Revolution. I think enormously detrimental in what they did, and it led to the mass slaughter in the 20th century and the rise of communism and various forms of totalitarianism. But it's so for good or ill, this is what the job is. It's to interpret the world for people. And there's a real division of labor in regard to this. And what it takes then, let me just very briefly make a few points about what it takes, It takes a real serious interest and a personal interest in ideas of how they work, of what ideas are positive, how they can advance individual human life and society and culture more broadly, what ideas are detrimental or evil or undermining of an individual's life and flourishing, how do they impact and infect the world around us? What are the arguments offered in favor of them? Can I understand them? I have to grapple with them. And then what are better alternatives? What are better solutions? It takes a real interest, indeed a passion for ideas. And then it takes real work, studying, training to understand what you think is true, what you think is false, and why, and take the best cases for the best arguments, the best books for the things that you think are wrong, and really grapple with them, study them, and think, yeah, no, I'm convinced this is wrong, and this is the alternative of what is right. So it takes real study, passion, and it takes a perseverance. You'll be confused, uncertain, often in this journey. I mean, I can remember myself as an undergraduate studying philosophy, economics, regularly being confused by, like, there's something that seems true here in what I'm studying. There's something that seems wrong. I can't quite figure out either. Some arguments seem plausible, but the conclusion seems really implausible. And I can't make head or tails of this, but I've got to keep working. So that, I think, if you're not often sort of puzzled, confused, you're not really engaged in the work. And then I'll say one other thing that I think is really important. This takes some moral courage. And this is part of what Ayn Rand is emphasizing in For the New Intellectual, particularly because what she's arguing, and this is true if you pick up Atlas Shrugged and read it, what she's arguing is we're in the midst of a lot of bad ideas. So to challenge these ideas, you're going to often be called crazy, as Ayn Rand was throughout her life. She was attacked and smeared in really bad and dishonorable ways. But you have to have some courage that this is going to happen. It's not going to happen all the time, and not everyone's going to do it. But if you're challenging mainstream ideas, you're going to be attacked. And particularly if you're challenging moral ideas and saying, and this, I mean, throughout Ayn Rand's work in Atlas Shrugged and For the New Intellectual, and indeed in almost anything you pick up by Ayn Rand, she's arguing a wrong morality is corrupting our lives at a personal level and a social political level. And if you're going to challenge people's moral beliefs, one thing you're going to be met with is people are going to say, no, what you're wrong, you're evil, because you're challenging, you're saying good's evil and evil is good from their perspective. And for many people, that's perverse to do. So you'll be met with a lot of moral opposition, and it takes moral courage to stand up to that. But to have moral courage takes intellectual conviction. It's even why it's more important that you put in the work to study, to understand the ideas that you're fully convinced that they're true. And the more you're fully convinced that they're true, the more it's possible to stand up to opposition, both intellectual and moral. So that's a little bit about why I became an objectivist intellectual, what I think the job is, and what Ayn Rand is emphasizing that the job of a proper intellectual is, a little bit of why it, what it takes. And let me just say to close, it's enormously rewarding. Like, if you have a passion for ideas, this kind of work, it's fun, it's challenging, you're every day learning new things, discovering new connections. If you really want to be a maker of knowledge, and you have ambition, and you have perseverance, then you're all constantly learning new things, doing new things, and you're helping people at their personal level to enlighten their minds and to enrich their lives. So it's an enormously fun and enormously rewarding task and career. So it's the best decision I made was to change careers. I can't imagine now being an engineer that because this is what I was actually interested in and passionate about. Okay, let me draw a line there, and I almost stayed with you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.